From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. It was not the first school shooting in the U.S., but it grabbed the public's focus and reverberates still. 20 years ago this week, two seniors at Columbine High School in Colorado killed 12 fellow students and a teacher, wounded others, and turned the guns on themselves. The tragedy changed school security protocols and attitudes toward mental health, but similar scenes have played out since. The mother of one of the shooters, Sue Klebold, still wonders what she had missed and has tirelessly advocated for mental health awareness.
I think the most important advice that I ever give, because I wish someone had said it to me, is as a parent, the most important thing we can do is to just shut up and listen.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. On April 20th, it will be 20 years since the shooting at Columbine High School in Colorado forever changed how Americans think of the safety of their children at school. Seniors Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, armed with an array of weapons and explosives, killed 12 students and a teacher and wounded more than 20 others before taking their own lives. The Columbine shooting was a blueprint for at least some of the dozens of school shootings that have unfolded since. Sue Klebold, Dylan's mother, racked by guilt and grief after the shooting, says she has thought of the victims every day of these 20 years. She calls what her son did suicide by murder. Her memoir, published in 2016, is titled A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy. I spoke with Sue Klebold when she came to Annapolis in February to speak to the Mental Health Association of Maryland. Sue Klebold, welcome to On the Record.
Thank you, Sheila. Thank you for having me.
What kind of kid was Dylan when he was little?
Dylan was what I would certainly consider a very normal kid. He was rambunctious. He never had, in all his years of growing up, any kind of a diagnosis of any kind of malfunction, pathology. He was in a gifted program at school. He was a blonde kid, his hair just stuck out like a lion's mane. He was playful, he was intelligent, he had a tremendously long attention span. He could read books like Stuart Little and Charlotte's Web silently to himself by the time he was 4 years old. He was fascinated by numbers and Legos and origami and puzzles, and he was affectionate. He was just a wonderful kid.
How did Dylan change as he became a teenager?
He changed in the ways that most adolescents change. I think when he was in the end of sixth grade, seventh grade, eighth grade, he became much more self-conscious. He didn't want to be different. He wanted to be like everybody else and just sort of blend in and not stand out in any way. When he got to junior high, he didn't want to appear to be smart because he didn't want to stand out. But he had friends. He was interested in things like fantasy baseball, and he went bowling, and he built his own computer when he was in 10th grade through a class in school, so he was spending time on the computer. So, you know, from what I could see, he was changing in the ways that adolescents usually change, and I wasn't seeing any kind of a darkness or pathway into anything that was alarming.
He and his friend Eric got into some trouble in their junior year, right?
Well, in Dylan's junior year, he began to show a couple of behaviors that were bothersome to me. He got in trouble at school for a few things. One was scratching a locker. One was he and his friends, who were the computer technicians for the school, hacked into the school system and got locker combinations. And then in that little cluster where he was showing that he was having some trouble, he and Eric stole some equipment from a parked van that was on a country road near where we lived. And they were immediately arrested and caught. And they were put into a diversion program because this was a first offense. This was a complete shock to our family. We couldn't understand how he could do such a thing. But I didn't know then what I know now, that such an abrupt change in behavior could be indicative of some kind of a mental health issue, or some kind of a change in one's thinking. I just treated it as, you've made a mistake. We talked about what would be an appropriate response from the family. I remember asking the diversion counselor, you know, does he need counseling? Does this mean something? And at that time, nobody seemed to think that it did. We didn't. That was 20 years ago. And I remember the counselor asking Dylan, what do you think? Do you think you need counseling? And Dylan said, no, I will prove to you. I am fine. I don't need counseling. And he did. He got his life on track. He continued in school to succeed. He never got in trouble again. He was accepted and applied to four colleges. He was in, did sound technicians for the school plays. He held an after-school job. So from what I could see, he had kept his promise of getting back on track and doing what he was supposed to do. What I was not aware of was the extreme dysfunction going on in his thinking, and it was, he worked hard, I'm sure, to hide those things from people.
What is your most vivid memory of April 20th, 1999?
The police came to our home. We learned that Dylan was suspected of being a perpetrator. SWAT teams came, and they didn't let us in our house. So what I remember of that day is sitting on the ground outside on the concrete steps out in front of our house, and watching helicopters overhead and watching cars line up along the road, and me just over and over and over and again asking the police, where's Dylan? Is he okay? What's happening? And no one seemed to know.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Sue Klebold. 20 years ago, her son Dylan and a teenage friend perpetrated the first high-profile mass shooting at an American school, Columbine High School in Colorado. I know your life has been full of challenges since the shooting, breast cancer, panic attacks, the end of your marriage. I want to focus on how you came to the conclusion that Dylan intended to die that day, that the Columbine Massacre was essentially a suicide.
Well, accepting someone's death as a suicide is not just a one-step thing. For example, in the very beginning, when we first got the coroner's report, which was just very soon after the incident, within the next probably 48 hours, the coroner said that Dylan's death was a suicide. And at that time, what suicide meant and what it was a result of was not in any way anything that I comprehended or understood. 6 months after the tragedy, we received the police report that really explained what happened. After this shooting happened, I was very much in denial, and so were all the people who loved Dylan, that he could be responsible for doing something as horrible as he did. It didn't fit who we thought Dylan was. We didn't think he was capable of that kind of violence, rage. When the police report came out, I had gone into it with a bunch of questions because I believed that Dylan was tricked or coerced or that he didn't know what was going to happen and he found himself there. So it was 6 months after the shootings where I really got to hear for the first time that he planned to be there, that this was something that took a long time, that there was extensive planning involved, and that he intended to die. How I knew that was that he had made a tape where he said goodbye, and you know, and that made me finally aware that he had gone into this situation with the intent of dying. And that really changed what I was perceiving about what happened, and I began to get more involved in understanding suicide prevention, spending time with other suicide loss survivors, reading books on suicide. and I could see the kinds of deterioration in one's thinking that occurs before someone dies by suicide. And then there was this horrible other piece of him killing and hurting other people. So it took really years to try to put all those pieces together for me to understand and accept what happened.
Do you worry that in your work you are reinforcing the stereotype that mentally ill people are dangerous, that they're prone to violence?
I am very concerned about that. And this is one of the difficulties we have when we talk about how mental illness and violent acts interplay with each other. The last thing I want to do is make life more difficult for people who have a mental illness, because most often they are likely to be victims of violence rather than to perpetrate violence. But we have to look at these rare scenarios. Certainly, let's look at something like a murder-suicide. For people who die in a murder-suicide, they take their own lives and take the lives of other people. This is a very rare phenomenon, really. It's only about 1 or 2% of all suicides involve taking the lives of someone else. And then in those, there are different types of murder-suicide, and it's certainly a mass murder-suicide where there are victims who are randomly chosen. That is the rarest of that type. So what I am focusing on is people have to understand this is a very small population of people. However, of school shooters who have taken part in events such as Columbine, in 2004, the Secret Service came out with a report that estimated that about 78% of those people who did the school shootings were suicidal at the time. Not all of these people do die on site. Some who are not suicidal might be killed on site. But in other reports I've read, it probably close to half at least, maybe 40 to 78%, have some suicidality. So my focus on suicidality is not only to help those who are struggling with suicidal thoughts, but also those rare few who might also be considering hurting others, that if we can have a stronger suicide prevention process in place for society, that we can help, I believe, reduce some of these mass shootings.
You prefer the term brain illness to mental illness and brain health to mental health. Why?
Because it is, I believe, it's a more concrete thing that we can understand a little better. What we really are talking about is the difference between what is the mind and what is the brain. And, you know, the mind is what governs us. It is how we think, how we feel, the decisions that we make. But I believe that there is a very close link between the physiology of what's going on in the brain and in the body to how we perceive that things are going on. And I think something like a murder-suicide is a good example of how the brain is malfunctioning and causing a lack of an ability to make rational decisions, to do something that is terribly harmful to so many people. So I was interviewing someone and who talked about brain illness, brain health, and as I was writing the book, was interviewing experts. And there really are changes in the brain when one is suicidal. And I think as science advances, we're going to see more of this physiological connection to that state of mind that is so dire and so lethal.
We need to take a short pause here on the record. We're speaking with brain health advocate Sue Klebold. 20 years after the Columbine school shooting, she is still analyzing why her son Dylan took part in it. When we're back, I'll ask what clues she thinks she missed. This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking today with Sue Klebold, suicide prevention activist. She's the mother of Dylan Klebold, who was 17 two decades ago when he and a classmate killed 12 fellow students and a teacher at Columbine High School in Colorado and wounded 20 others before taking their own lives. Her memoir, published 3 years ago, is A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy. She's donated all the author's profits to mental health and suicide prevention and research and support. You write that one of the most common questions you face is, how could you not have known? And I imagine you've gotten pretty skilled in answering that.
At first, when people asked me that question, it was a terrifying, horrible feeling. It made me feel attacked, because the implication behind that question is, if you'd been a good mother, you would have known, because mothers are supposed to know everything. As time went on and I worked and talked with many other survivors of suicide loss, I realized that about half of us don't know when our loved ones are considering suicide. And one of the problems with someone who is suicidal is very often they work hard to hide what they're thinking and feeling for all kinds of reasons. They don't want to be perceived as weak. They don't want to perhaps feel that revealing such a thing might jeopardize their careers. They don't want to be perceived that they have anything wrong with their mental well-being, because there's such a stigma attached to having any kind of a mental illness. So there are all kinds of reasons. What that means is we need to learn new skills for how to communicate with people that we love. If we see a change in behavior, if we suspect that a crisis in their lives has driven them to a point of danger, one thing we can do is ask, to learn how to listen more carefully, to listen without judgment, and to ask if someone is experiencing suicidal thoughts. Anything can indicate that someone is struggling with suicidality, such as maybe a change in sleep pattern, sleeping too much or sleeping too little.
Did you see those kinds of changes in Dylan?
I did not. I did not see them. I didn't see a lot of things, but they existed at the time.
Like what?
For example, purchasing a firearm when they're or some means by which to die. We had no guns in our house, but Dylan and Eric had bought guns. One of Dylan's best friends knew that he had purchased a gun. In fact, two of his friends knew, but he had asked them not to tell. Today, if a youngster learns that a friend has purchased a firearm and is asked not to tell their parents, they would know that that is a warning sign of suicide, that obtaining the means by which to die is something they should be concerned about and should know how to ask, or should know to refer this to a caring adult who would know how to respond. So that was one of the risks that was missed. When we talk about people who are at risk for suicide, very often there is what we call leakage. There is someone that they tell, or they talk about this, they talk about a plan. In Dylan's case, he didn't talk about it orally, but he wrote about it on pieces of paper. We found among the papers that the police gave back to us long after his death that at the age of 15, he was writing that he was in agony and wanted to die. And he wrote, "I want to get a gun and kill myself." He also referred to the fact that he was cutting himself. And so that was 2 years before his death. So there are many signs that someone might exhibit, but very often the signs that we see are typical of that age group. So the important thing we have to learn to do is how to ask and how to listen differently.
Yeah, I want to pursue that. I'm not a parent, but how can you tell whether this isn't just a typically moody adolescent?
Not only is it hard for us to tell, it's hard for the individual to tell. Very often, the individual himself doesn't understand what he is feeling is a potential life-threatening crisis. So I think the most important advice that I ever give, because I wish someone had said it to me, is as a parent, the most important thing we can do is to just shut up and listen. As parents, we are so concerned about trying to help our children. We want to make them feel better when they are having problems. And we very often say things that contradict what they're feeling, like, oh, you're just tired, or you'll feel better tomorrow, or, you know, why don't you eat something? Or I don't think you're ugly, or I think you're funny. All these things that we say as parents. And by doing that, we don't realize it, but we are cutting off their ability to tell us what they are feeling and thinking. And one of the important first steps that we all need to do for our loved ones is to just not try so hard to help, but just to stop talking and say, tell me more about that. I want to hear more about your feelings. And regardless of what they say, to let them know that we are there for them. We are not going to punish them or judge them for what they are saying, but we're going to be there with them to help them, connect to resources.
That's Sue Klebold, brain health advocate here on the record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Her 17-year-old son, Dylan, took part in the Columbine School massacre 20 years ago. If there had been, before 1999, another mass shooting that had killed a dozen students and a teacher and wounded 20 others, do you think you, as a parent, would have been looking for signs? I mean, is part of why you were gobsmacked that America really hadn't seen this before?
Well, that's not true. There have been school shootings for decades before Columbine. I think what made Columbine stand out as it has, as this benchmark, was it was the beginning of 24/7 news coverage. And for the first time, our country was there in the faces of people who were suffering and weeping and terrified. And we were there for the whole community as they went through all the things that they went through, their sorrow, their anger. Our governor got on television to say that this was the fault of the parents. There were blame, there was lawsuits, there were all kinds of things. And Columbine was also unusual in that it was two perpetrators. It was a double murder-suicide, which is also a more of a statistical rarity. So for all kinds of reasons, Columbine always became this event, this bellwether event that people look to say everything changed. But in reality, Columbine was just another school shooting. But America was not aware that these things were happening. We weren't tuned in. And I think for the first time, people were horrified to say this can happen in families that are values, that their values are shared by middle-class America. This is a supposedly safe community. This is a high school of high standards that is a sort of a college preparatory high school. I think for the first time it said to us, this can happen anywhere. This isn't something that just happens where there's poverty, where there's high crime rates. This is something that can happen anywhere to anyone.
Have you made peace with what happened?
Peace is kind of a broad term. Certainly as a mother who has lost a child, who has known that that child hurt other children, I don't think I'll ever be at peace with that. That kind of pain never goes away. As a mother of a child who died by suicide, there is always a piece of me that will never forgive myself, because a mother's job is to protect her child, to understand them, to make them safe. And when we lose loved ones to suicide, very often we perceive that to be our failure, that we failed to do that. But on the other hand, having made peace, I have learned a lot about this. I have learned a lot about how when one is suicidal, one does not have the access to the same tools that we do when we are well. And I believe a lot of what happened was a kind of illness in a way, without saying that Dylan was mentally ill, because he never did have a diagnosis. But there is a realm there where I truly believe that Dylan did not understand the magnitude of what he was doing or the impact it would have on others. I think he was in a very childlike place in his thinking. And when I understand this kind of a loss, I have to say to people, if I had to explain this to a child, I would say, Dylan got sick in his brain. Something happened. And because of that, he hurt himself and he hurt other people. And that is the way I have come to think of it. And if that's making peace with it, perhaps it is. But I never, ever get over the fact that he hurt other people along the way.
I'm really grateful to you for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure. Thanks, Sheila.
Sukli Bold's son Dylan was 17 when he and a classmate perpetrated the mass shooting at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado. That was April 20th, 1999. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-TALK, 1-800-273-8255. At the On the Record page at WYPR, we have a link to Sukli Bold's TED Talk and to information about her book, A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy. I'm Sheila Kass. Glad you're with us on the record. Come back tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Kass. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.